Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Mick Clifford podcast with the Irish Examiner. Now, a bit of a treat for you today. Dennis Minhin has just retired as one of the longest serving press photographers in the country, having spent 47 years employed by the Examiner. Initially, of course, it was the Cork Examiner and subsequently the Irish Examiner. It's fair to say that Dennis is a bit of a legend in the business. He's also a great talker, which we'll come to in a minute. But his career spanned some huge events in Irish and international history, at which he was in attendance, trying always for the perfect shot. One estimate in the newspaper has it that Dennis took over 500,000 photographs in the course of his career. So what was it like being the man with the camera, and what stories lurked behind some of those award-winning and sometimes iconic photographs? Dennis, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mick. Thank you very much.
You made it to the finish line intact anyway, Dennis.
I did indeed. It went so quick for many years, my goodness, I didn't even notice. Didn't even notice at all.
Always the way. Tell me, we'll start with your background. You're from West Cork.
Yeah, from Skibbereen. Grew up in Britt Street and Skibbereen.
And where did you develop the interest in photography?
Through, I guess, really because of my father, Michael. My father, Michael, became a photographer. He wasn't initially when he was younger, having grown up outside Skibbereen in a place called Cunnamore Church Cross in Skibbereen. He ended up coming to Cork. He was in the army for a short while, and then he ended up milking cows on Model Farm Road, strangely enough. And after that, he became a fisherman. He got injured while he was fishing in that he fell between the pier and the trawler at Kinsale. And so did some serious injury to his back, and he spent 3 years recovering from that. And somebody had the bright idea who was visiting him, and they brought in a set of paintbrushes and started him off in painting, drawing, sketching, doing watercolors. And it passed the time for him, I suppose, when he was in the hospital. He probably wasn't in for the 3 years in total, but he was in and out. And in general, it took him 3 years to recuperate, developed a watercolour idea, started painting, sketching, and I suppose when he went home, that transformed itself into photography. So he went from drawing and painting to photography. It developed his eye, I suppose, for it, and he started doing wedding photographs and communions and confirmations and all local events, and then ended up getting a job with the Cork Examiner, and that's how I grew up. We all grew up in a newspaper house, really. We also had a small shop, so we had a newsagents in Britt Street and Skibbereen. So I was born into it. It was in the blood, as they say.
Oh, great. So your dad worked for the Examiner as well.
He did. Yeah.
And was there any formal training or anything in those days, Dennis? Or how did you get the start, as we call it?
There was no training, Mick. No. I mean, people nowadays go to college, I suppose, and study more often than not. But no, there was no training. No, I just used to go in every now and again into the dark room. We had a dark room set up in our house because we were so far away from Cork that he had to develop the films and print the photographs in Skibbereen. So I used to go in when I was a youngster and watch him developing the films and then doing the prints. And I suppose slowly he left me try it out and got used to it. And it went from there.
Do you recall your first bit of work professionally? As a photographer?
My goodness, I probably would have to say I don't.
Normally in anything like these, Dennis, there's something, if not the very first from the very early days, that always sticks, but there's nothing that jumps out.
I suppose I was doing, say, when I was in school, I used to write stories as well for the Examiner and the Echo. I covered local events, maybe annual general meetings, the election of councillors, possibly sporting events, anything that was kind of happening in the Skibbereen area. And I would, in those days it was called lineage. So I would get so much, I would get a penny a line for every line that was published. And then you would get 3 pence a line for the headline. And then, of course, you'd hope that the headline went across 2 or 3 or 4 columns. So you could multiply that by the number of columns. And that's what I was doing when I was in school, just for a bit of fun, really. But it developed into a way that I continued to do it. And then in those days, there was a reverse line number in the Examiner in Cork. So you would ring the reverse number. And I had my story written out and call out, read it out. And the girls in the office, Sandra or whoever was on duty that night, would type it. And it ended up in the paper, and I would get so much a line for that. So it started like that. And then I was doing a little bit of photography with my father as well. I used to go to things, and I suppose I would take pictures myself and send them in on a chance sending them in. And sometimes they would end up on the Cork Weekly Examiner. So it kind of developed that way, and doing bits and pieces every now and again. And so I planned to go into journalism, and was doing a shorthand and typing course when a job came up in the Examiner. I was only about 6 weeks into the course. The job came up in the dark room, and I got the job. And I remember Donal Crosby, and God rest his soul, and I mean, they were a great family, the Crosbys. Donal said to me, "Well, Dennis, you're going to be on a 6-month trial." And I haven't heard back to this day. Make 47 years later, I'm still waiting. I haven't heard a word back.
You were on trial for 47 years, so at that
so I suppose I was doing a bit of photography before I started. And then when I went in, I was working in the dark room for the bones of a year and a half to 2 years, thinking I'd be in the dark room for much longer before I got an opportunity. But at weekends, when I was in the dark room, I would go home to Skibbereen. I sometimes hitched a lift, I thumbed down to Skibbereen, or other times I got the bus. And during those weekends, I would maybe take some photographs, maybe a lovely sunset or nature picture or wildlife or whatever. And when I come back up, then if Frank Sanquist, the art editor, was on a Sunday night and I happened to be working the night shift on the Sunday, he'd often say to me, "Dennis, did you get any nice photograph over the weekend?" And I'd say, "Well, actually, sometimes I would say, Frank, I did. I got a lovely sunset or a lovely view of Loch Inne." He said, "Do a print and let me have a look at it." And oftentimes they ended up as a half page on the Examiner the following day, or in the Weekly Examiner a few days later. So I kind of eased myself into it that way before I went out on the road.
Yeah, it's great. As you said, it's great to have that kind of a start.
Yes, yes.
And to learn from the bottom up.
Yes, yes.
Now, obviously, and stuff down in the south in particular, Dennis, within the Examiner's catchment area and what have you, certainly initially back in those days, there was always big stories that would have been around. And one of the major stories there in the 80s, I think, was the Air India crash. And you did some work around that.
I did indeed. Yeah, that was a terrible tragedy at the time. It really was.
Tell us a bit about it itself, the story. It was a plane that came down, wasn't it, just off Cork?
That's right. It was the plane blew up off the West Cork coast. Yeah, it did. It did indeed. It was flying past Ireland, and the bomb went off and it exploded off the Irish coast. That's right.
And a lot of the debris and the bodies were all brought ashore.
Many of the bodies were found and brought ashore, and debris as well. Yeah, the Navy was out there searching for many days. Yes, indeed. There were some tragic and upsetting scenes at that time. There sure were.
And I think you'd some photographs in particular, and it was very tragic, obviously, but it sort of brought home the tragedy of it, as only photographs can in some instances. I think you had a photograph wherever the bodies were laying out at one stage.
Yeah, they were. I had a photograph of some of the bodies in a temporary morgue set up in Cork Regional Hospital. I had indeed. I mean, earlier on that day, I suppose I had actually been working at two hurling games in Thurles. That's where I was that day, and I was travelling with Jim O'Sullivan, and I travelled together, and we'd arrived in Thurles, turned on the RT Radio 1 news, and at 11 o'clock, and the news came on that there was a plane after going down off the Cork coast. And so, I mean, I worked at the games that day, came back, and when I got back to Cork, I was hardly able to get into the dark room to process my pictures from the match, because there were so many international photographers in there who had arrived to cover that awful tragedy. of Air India. So I eventually got to process my pictures, and later on that evening I was asked would I go out. There was a press conference in the region. Would I go out and see if I get some photographs there that might relate to the fact that it was, you know, it was Cork was where all this was happening.
What would strike as well, I suppose, what people often think, you know, about different lines of work, how people approach things, but something like that, and I'm sure there's been other occasions as well, a very harrowing scene. And it's, I suppose, in some ways harrowing that people would nearly turn away from it. But because of your profession, because of your craft, you have to kind of remove yourself from that in those instances. You're taking the photographs. Would that be right?
Yeah, you'd be right there. Yeah, you obviously have personal feelings and emotional about the whole thing, but you have to remove yourself in some ways, I suppose, from it, and just try and do your job as well. And on that night when I went to the regional hospital, there was obviously a lot of international media there. There were camera photographers, reporters, TV crews. And I think some of the international photographers thought that they would be allowed to take a photograph of the remains in, a general photograph, as I suppose they had done at other international events, which I wouldn't have experienced. But they weren't allowed. So I took what I could at the press conference, and then I moved around and I was looking down. I was trying to figure out where the remains were, and I found the temporary morgue where they were, and I could see the door, but didn't get any further than that, obviously. And so I went around the back of the building and had a look, and I could see now there were quite thick net curtains hanging in the window, so I could see the remains inside, but it was too dark to actually get a photograph. You couldn't get a photograph with the net curtains. You could just barely get a view in. So I wasn't sure what I was doing, to be honest, what to do. I was waiting around for quite some time. I had my car parked on the ground, so I decided to take the car out, and I parked down the road, and I walked back in a side entrance and went back to the window, and I was waiting for a while. I suppose I could see there was activity in the room and they were trying to identify the remains, and that was a very difficult task, no doubt, for all the people involved that time. And eventually somebody came down and they opened the window up high, way up over my head. They opened the window and I thought I'd been seen, so I went around the corner, but nobody had come out to me or anything, so I went back around again and I saw the window had been opened. And the curtain started to blow just a little with the slight breeze that was coming in the window up higher. And so I managed to get a few frames. It was only an instant, really. It was only a couple of seconds. I think I got 7 frames. The curtain went in just past the windowsill, and I had about a 2-inch gap between the curtain and the windowsill. So the frame in the actual photograph, the top third of the photograph is the net curtain, the bottom of the net curtain, and the lower part of it is the windowsill. And then I managed to get the picture of the remains in between that. So I got 7 frames. I think 3 or 4 of them were usable. But, I managed to get that. But at the same time, I was probably on a manual exposure, so it was film in those days, so I didn't really know exactly what I had got, to be honest, Mick.
And the story was so huge. I mean, it was a terrorist bomb that had blown up the plane, and everybody aboard had died, that there was international interest, understandably, in it. And I think your photograph, did it go to Life magazine as well?
It did, yeah, it did. It went to Life magazine, called me on the Monday, but it happened on the Sunday, and on the Monday afternoon was it, happened to be in the office, and I got a call from a lady from New York, I think, called and was looking to speak to the photographer who took the picture, and I so happened to be there. And she was wondering if it was possible to get an original copy of the photograph. Now, at that stage earlier in the day, obviously the Examiner and the Echo had used it that morning, and when I came in early 7 o'clock that Monday morning, and the lads in the wire room technicians and the wire room operators said that the picture had been wired to so many newspapers that there was an incredible interest in it. And you'd wonder in those days, Mick, how the newspapers even heard so much about it, heard about the photograph. I mean, it's different nowadays when you have such modern technology with instant. But they did somehow. And the lady from New York said that they wanted to get an original copy. And I think they were going to hold, they were ready to go to print with Life magazine, but they held on if they could get a copy of the photograph. So I had to, it wasn't my call, I had to get permission, because I mean I was working for the Examiner, so I had to get permission from management upstairs. So they gave the go ahead. So I did a large print. They wanted as large a print as possible. Did a large print. I put it into an envelope, well, a package, but it was well protected. I had a lot of cardboard around the print to protect it. So I put it into a taxi at the door. The taxi took it to Cork Airport. They flew it to London, and it was flown to New York. Just a print, just an envelope with the print. And she called me the following day, and that lady did, and said that they got it, and thank you very much, and that they were going to use it across the two pages of Life magazine, and that they were going to give me a credit and the Cork Examiner, and that they were grateful. That she said it was the biggest news story in the world at the time, I guess, really, sadly. But so that was that as such.
And it's fascinating, all right, you're talking about the taxi to the airport. So younger people would have no concept of this at all. The notion in terms of how something goes around the world, you press a button now and bang, it's gone.
Yeah, it is.
Right around the world in a fraction of a second. But a thing I wonder about that, Dennis, because such a sensitive scenario, and obviously also it was illustrative of the horrendous tragedy that had happened, was there any negative vibes, any suggestion that it was intruding on a scenario or anything like that? Or would that have arisen at all? Now, I presume in terms of you being the photographer, your first instance is get the picture and other people can worry about that. But was there any criticism in that respect?
I've no doubt there was, Mick. Being what it wasn't the easiest photograph to look at. You know, it was very difficult. It must have been very difficult for the families as well if they saw it. You know, all the relatives, because the relatives were arriving from Canada and from India over the next few days or the next week, really. So it can't have been easy for them. No, of course not. And I'm sure it wasn't an easy decision either. You know, in the office that night to use the picture as well in the first place.
Yeah,
it wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't, and for me either. But I mean, as you say, it was. I suppose it was the job at the time. And. And I know there was a photograph already on our wire system of a body of somebody being airlifted from the scene. You know, somebody's remains being airlifted from the scene. So they did have that photograph already. So it was difficult. It was difficult, and I know I felt so sorry for all those people afterwards. You know, there was no intent to upset anyone, but I've no doubt it must have caused some distress. It would have, and I'm sure some people in the regional hospital weren't too happy with me either, I would say.
Yeah, and out of curiosity, in terms of a scenario like that, was there any repercussions for you from the regional hospital in terms of access or anything afterwards, or is that just something that people move on?
There wasn't, no. I probably didn't go there for a while afterwards, I would probably imagine.
Yeah, I can well imagine.
No, there wasn't, no. I mean, I know that there were vibes, and I felt that I knew people weren't, some people weren't happy about it, and they were, I suppose they were probably looking into how did I manage to get it and all that, you know. And
that's the eternal dilemma in journalism all the time. You know, as you say, your job is others make a decision, but there is that thing. It is illustrative. It does bring home the horror of what has been perpetrated.
It does, and I suppose it did. It did show the enormity of what happened. Really, it definitely brought it home. And I suppose I remember they had that was 23rd of June 1985. Was it the
30 years? 30, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Was that the there was an anniversary. Was it the 25th? I think that the ambassadors were at it, and actually, they asked would I come along to it, which was actually, you know, it was an ease to my mind, really, that the Cork University Hospital, as it was, asked me would I like to attend, which, you know, was amazing, really. I didn't expect that, and it was very kind of them and gracious of them. And so I attended.
You were also displaced from Cork, so to speak. You were over at the release of the Birmingham Six. That would have been in 1991. Somebody told me the story there about a 7-foot ladder you used, because you got a great shot that day as well. I have to say it really brought home the emotions of the men who were there. Your shot in their face, it was really, really powerful. Tell us what was behind that.
Well, I suppose it had been going on all week. This was coming up and it looked like they were going to be released. I can't remember the exact details, but I was sent over on Wednesday, I think. They were due to be released on the Friday, if memory serves me right. I could be wrong now, but I think it was. I was sent over 2 days before they were due to be released. Got into London and went to my hotel. I think the hotel was probably a late booking because it was quite a kind of a fancy hotel I was staying in. Not that I spent much time there, but got to the hotel, checked in, went in to Fleet Street and off then the side street up to the Old Bailey. And I couldn't believe it. There were so many photographers and they were corralled in. There were barriers around and they were corralled into a kind of a semicircle up the street from the Old Bailey. And there were photographers standing on the ground, there were photographers on steps, there were photographers on higher steps, there were photographers on ladders, step ladders. And I said, oh my goodness, how am I going to get a picture here? I knew I couldn't get to the front because I was one of the later ones to arrive. So I had in around the back, and sure, I could see nothing because there were so many photographers there. There were dozens of photographers, could see nothing. So I had to get a ladder. So I headed off searching for a ladder, and eventually I found a place near the hotel I was staying where I managed to purchase a 7-foot ladder. Went back to the hotel with the ladder. I knew I wouldn't have a hope of getting photographs without the ladder. Went back to the hotel with the ladder, and I think the porter probably thought I was working there. I remember he was wearing top hat and tails, and quite a fancy hotel, and he thought I was working there. So I just took the ladder up to the room following morning, then came back down out with the ladder, and I was trying to figure out how was I going to get the ladder into the Old Bailey. And so the only way we could do it was a taxi, one of the larger taxis in London, and the ladder out the front left window and out the back right window. And I was sitting in the back seat holding it. And he agreed to take me. He was probably saying, who's this Irish fella going around with a 7-foot ladder? But anyway, he took me in, put my ladder in at the back of the photographers. And so I had my view and I was up at the back. And then another photographer arrived from, I think, was it the Sunday World later in the day, and he had to do the same thing. So that day was the day before they were due to be released, and we all sort of were getting our lunch and sandwiches and just staying nearby. I hung around, I got a sandwich, and I was getting a sandwich. I hung around, I heard a lot of shouting. So I went out, I ran out, and I went up the ladder, and I said, my goodness, what's going on? I could see people, a lot of commotion outside the Old Bailey, and I could see people running out. So I jumped down and I got the camera, went back up the ladder with the long lens, and just a couple of minutes later, the Birmingham Six came running out. It was unbelievable. If memory serves me right, I think they weren't due to come out until the following day. They came out a day early. I think I could be wrong, or maybe they were to come out later in the day, later that day, but I think they weren't expected out until the following day. So they came running out, and I had a picture of five of them kind of embracing outside the door. I think Jerry Conlon, came out first. I can't remember exactly now, and went to the crowd because there were hundreds of people across the street shouting and cheering and waving, you know, waiting for them to come out. So, and then the six of them came up. They came up and stood in front of all the photographers. So we got some very strong pictures on that day. Yeah, incredible. And of course,
it was quite an emotion-packed day.
It was, really was. And so I was supposed to process in Press Association on Fleet Street because Ted Crosby, God rest his soul, was involved with Press Association. And so I had got permission to process there and contacted PA, and they were snowed under with people because of this, because the whole thing happened so suddenly with the release. And so much earlier than expected, and they said that it would be later in the day or the evening before they'd be able to process my films and print the photographs. So I rang the office, went to a payphone, I rang the office, and I said, I think it was Dermot Russell was on the desk, and I said, Dermot, the Birmingham Six are out, I have photographs. PA won't be able to. We're so busy that they wouldn't be able to help me out for a few hours. Should I go back to Cork or what will I do? And he said, do that, Dennis. He said, go to Heathrow. I'll organise the flight. The plane flight will be ready for you when you get to Heathrow and come back with the films. So then I was standing on Fleet Street after speaking with Dermot, and I had a 7-foot ladder. What was I going to do with a 7-foot ladder? So I rang my wife, Maeve. Her sister, Geraldine, lived in outside London. I rang her and I said, would you use a 7-foot ladder? And she said, we certainly would, no bother at all. So into a taxi again, the same way as I had come in that morning, out the two windows, and I holding the ladder on the back, got to the hotel and asked the porter, would he mind holding onto the ladder overnight for me, and that my sister-in-law would collect in the morning. He said he would. So I remember I gave him a £10 note. I gave him a tenner, ten pounds, and that was the ladder. And I made my way back to Heathrow and back to Cork. So I asked her recently, and she said that the ladder is, as far as she knows, they still have the ladder. Probably won't need to use it again, hopefully, in London.
Great beginnings for it, yeah.
To know what's really happening, subscribe to the Irish Examiner today at irishexaminer.com/subscribe.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
No, Hollywood came to Cork at one stage, Dennis, in the guise of one of the all-time great actors, Marlon Brando.
That's right.
You were dispatched. Was it Neis Cork he was? You were dispatched down there to see if you could get a photograph of him.
That's right. Neis Cork, they were filming. He was one of the stars of the film Divine Rapture, I think. Wasn't that the name of it? I think so, Divine Rapture.
Yeah, it ended up a disaster, I think.
They never finished, which is an awful shame.
There was other Hollywood actors in that too.
Deborah Winger was in it, and Johnny Depp.
That's right.
I remember photographing them. We were given limited access on the street in Ballycotton, every now and again, so there was limited access. I remember taking photographs of Deborah Winger and Johnny Depp walking along the street, and it was a fantastic setup with all the gear set up on the street in Ballycotton. But there was an issue that arose then, and they didn't want any more photographs taken. So Marlon Brando was back in the house he was staying in, and they were kind of didn't want any more photographs over whatever happened. So I was at the gate of the house he was staying in, outside the gate, with a reporter. Yeah. But we had heard that Michael D. Higgins, now President Higgins, was going to visit Marlon Brando.
He was Minister for the Arts at the time.
He was Minister for Arts and possibly Culture and the Gaels, I can't remember, but that kind of comes to mind. Right. Minister for Arts, and he was coming to meet Marlon Brando, I suppose to welcome him and just to chat with him. And obviously they were promoting filming in Ireland as well at the time, and which has taken off and developed so much so in a lot of ways now. And we waited outside the gate, and the car arrived with Michael D. Higgins, and we put in a request to know would it be possible to go and get photographs of him with Marlon Brando, and he said he'd inquire. And the word came back a while later that they were going to allow myself and the reporter in to meet them, to get a few words and to take the photograph. So we were allowed in, and there was a beautiful blazing fire inside in the room. And Marlon Brando and President Higgins were sitting in front of it, chatting, and we sat down and we had a cup of afternoon tea and some cake with the two of them. And unfortunately, there were no phones like there are nowadays in those days that I could have taken a few selfies of myself or the reporter with the two of them or with Marlon Brando or anything. But it was, I suppose, it's a lovely memory. They were chatting away. I took photographs of them chatting casually, and then we did a few pose photographs, and I had a couple of lovely close-up studies of Marlon Brando as well, smiling at me, and it was lovely. All I have is memories of it now, but anyway, they're lovely to have.
How was Brando?
He was fine. He was great, quite chatty. He chatted away. Not so much to us. It was more to President Higgins. But no, he was very interesting. And, you know, he chatted about different things and how he was delighted to be in County Cork and the beautiful scenery and all that, I would imagine. So, you know, it was lovely. No, we weren't there for very long because obviously they were having an official chat, I guess. So we were in there for a little while, but not that long. And we left then.
It's a great, from the outside, Dennis, it's a great way to earn a living. You're there and doing what you love and capturing all these photographs. You enjoyed it as a career.
Oh yeah. Oh God. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. No doubt. It was an incredible career. Really. It really was. I mean, I suppose I'd say I was born into it, but it was an incredible career. There's no doubt about it. I got to meet so many ordinary, decent people is the main thing, really. And then I also got to meet a lot of, you know, personalities and VIPs, got to a lot of big events, and it was just incredible. I traveled a bit as well. I mean, I was at the Pope's funeral in Rome. I covered the Pope's visit when he was in Ireland, Pope John Paul II, and that was in 1979, because Eddie O'Hare, the photographer, and Billy Higgins, who was the Royal Room technician and wire room operator at the time, we were in Dublin Airport for his arrival. Eddie and Richard Mills, another photographer, and I, we were flown up to Dublin the night before the Pope arrived. I think we stayed in Wynn's Hotel, and the following morning then we made our way to Eddie and I. The three of us actually went to Dublin Airport. Richard was doing colour photographs, and the reason we had flown up is that they were doing a special publication of the Examiner on a Sunday, which wasn't unheard of in those days. So they did a special publication. Richard was taking colour transparencies just of the Pope arriving, coming down the steps onto the ground, and a couple of quick shots of meeting people. Richard left and flew back on the plane that we'd come up on so that he could get the colour transparencies back. And I was on the ground then taking photographs, or in a stand taking photographs of the Pope. I mean, we were so close to him, really. I mean, I took photographs on a standard lens, a 50 millimeter lens. So he was only maybe 10, 12 feet away from us, looking over at us and waving and everything. So I would take a couple of rolls of film, and then I would jump down, go over to the edge of the car park, put the films into a bucket. Eddie was above. Eddie would had a rope attached to the bucket. Eddie pulled the rope up, pulled the rope and pulled the bucket up, got the films. And we had a van set up in the car park in Dublin Airport, and Eddie developed the films in the blacked out van. And, you know, windows were blacked out so that it was converted into a temporary dark room. Eddie developed the films and printed the pictures, and Billy wired the pictures, and I continued taking more photographs then.
Brilliant. One other event someone mentioned to me, I think it was Ireland when they won the Grand Slam in Wales in 2009.
That's right, the Millennium Stadium, yes.
The Millennium Stadium. That's the first Grand Slam it won in, I don't know, since the 40s. But
it was, yes.
Somebody said you had a sense, and that was won with a last-minute drop goal by Ronan O'Gara.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
You tell me about that.
Yeah, well, I suppose I would have known Ronan over the years, maybe, you know, meeting him at various things in Cork, and would have known his, you know, his parents as well, and Ron was always great guy. I even took photographs of him the day he graduated in UCC. His father was in UCC, and I remember bringing a rugby ball up there that day and asked the chance that they might pass a ball between them on in the quad in UCC for a photograph, and they agreed. They did it, so that made a good picture that day. So I would have known Ronan, and on the day of the game, which was an incredible occasion, it really was. The game was so tight with the scoreline. I think it was neck and neck, and you're right towards the end of the game. And I just had this sense that Ronan was going to kick a drop goal. Just had that feeling from, I suppose, seeing him playing other games and following his career. And I watched, I concentrated my focus on Ronan for maybe 5, probably 10 minutes. I was sitting at the corner flag, and I just had him in my viewfinder the whole time. And because I'd got lots of pictures of the game, so I figured if he was going to get a drop goal and he could win the game. So I watched him and watched him, and the ball came to him. I could see he was in the right spot, and he kicked the drop goal. So I had a picture of him kicking the ball. I could see the ball going up in the air, and the three Welsh players were in front of me then with their backs to me, and Ronan was facing me, and he put the ball over. And so I had pictures of him then with the hand up in the air and turning around celebrating as well. So yeah, I just figured that was going to happen, and thank God for me and for Ronan and for Ireland it did.
You had the right instinct. You were ahead of the game, as they say.
That was a great day with the celebrations afterwards and everything. It was just wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful, yeah.
In that respect. Tell me, Dennis, the nature of technology, the nature of photography, everything has gone on. Is the golden age past for press photography?
It's definitely changed, Mick, so much. It has. There's no doubt about it. It has. I mean, the phones now have changed everything, really, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, we went from black and white in those days where you wouldn't see. You never knew what you had until you processed the film and looked at the negatives and did the prints then and see exactly what you had. Now everything is... it went in from colour to colour transparencies onto colour film and then to digital, and it's everything is so instant now. As you said earlier on, you can have a picture sent around the world in seconds, and it has changed so much. It's got more difficult for press photographers, all right, no doubt, to try and get the shots, because oftentimes if you're at something and you have to stand in a particular position, you could have people in front of you who have phones up, and you're trying to, you can't get the shot with the phones or whatever. Like, I mean, oftentimes I would go to events and concerts, maybe school concerts or concerts wherever, and sit at the front, sitting on the floor, just getting nice pictures. But in the recent years, people would say, oh, we can't get a picture on our phone, you're in the way, and this sort of thing. So invariably, what I was to do then in recent years, I would actually go to the rehearsal. So that I wouldn't have any issue with phones. I go to the dress rehearsal maybe the day before and get my pictures there. So it has changed considerably, there's no doubt. It has.
I think it's an undervalued and understated skill and craft.
Yes, yes.
And long may it last. And Dennis, long may your retirement last. And I hope you've time to get out and pursue your passion without the same kind of pressures that would be there in a work scenario long into the future.
Thanks, Mick. I suppose, really, just before I finish up, I came from a long line of fantastic photographers down through the years. Initially with Paddy Barker and Tommy Barker's grandfather, Thomas Barker, would have taken photographs in the Titanic when it visited, you know, when it was stopped in Cork on its voyage, at the start of its voyage. And then down through the years, all my other colleagues, and I suppose without the support of my wife and family, because it is, you know, you're away a lot with that job. You could be gone for a day or you could be gone for days. And without my wife, Maeve's support and all that, you know, and the children, I would never have managed it, really, because the demands, there were great demands, but they were fantastic, enjoyable days. And, you know, I wouldn't think twice about doing it again, really. It was wonderful, and it was a great company to work for, The Examiner and The Echo. So anyway, thank you, Mick.
Lovely. Dennis, thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much, Mick. Thank you.
As always, I want to thank our engineer, JJ Vernon. Thank you, folks, for listening. Hope you enjoyed that. We'll talk to you again soon. Take it easy.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me? Like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.